are in Baird country. Okay, hello everybody. We have Chris Johnston here today. You might recognize Chris from some of my YouTube videos. He is the local blacksmith who lives off-grid downriver from me. He's got his own blacksmithing business. You can see him on Instagram at adventure_forge. He lives off-grid in the forest, and he's the kind of guy that has a background working with his hands, all this kind of stuff, but he basically left a corporate life behind and moved up to the bush. So I'm really excited to kind of dive into, you know, Chris's story a little bit more with him. Chris, welcome to the podcast, man. Thanks a lot for coming out today.
Thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. So what is your first recollection of blacksmithing?
I think my first recollection of blacksmithing was a school trip to Pioneer Village. Mm-hmm. And I remember the blacksmith making a nail. And we'll come full circle on that one, because it turns out I ended up meeting that guy maybe some years later.
The guy who was
the blacksmith at Pioneer Village. So always interested in blacksmithing. And then as a tool and die maker, I there's crossover, like the mm-hmm. names of things. It's all remnants of blacksmithing. The names of the different tools and dies all relate back to how blacksmiths did things 200 years ago and before. And so I started consuming books on blacksmithing and mm-hmm. took a job as a project manager at a plant in Toronto, which had been there since 1906, I believe. And in the tool room there was an anvil. And some years later, that business went under, and my friend was in charge of getting rid of all the assets, and some stuff was just going to end up in the scrap bin. So he says, "Is there anything you want?" I said, "Yeah, I want that anvil." So unbeknownst to me, it weighed 267 pounds.
And had you done any blacksmithing at this time yet?
No. Like maybe just a little bit of playing around with it and, heating something up with a torch and hitting with a hammer, but didn't have an anvil. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any real concept of how to do things correctly. I remember trying to forge weld once and, mm-hmm. Again, with a torch, and it was a completely ridiculous idea to think that might work in mm-hmm. hindsight. But that's how I learned things. I just try it. Mm-hmm. And figure out what works and what doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So I got the anvil. That sat around for a number of years. And again, I still was interested, but never set up a shop. And then one day I went to the antique market, and there was a rivet forge, which was pretty commonplace on farms. And they were used for heating rivets, like in bridge making. And there would be a guy on the ground. He'd heat a rivet up red hot. He'd put it in a cup, like a metal cup, and he'd throw it up in the air. And the guy up on the scaffolding would catch that hot rivet with his cup, and then he'd pick it up with tongs and put it inside the piece of the bridge they were going to rivet together, and there'd be two guys there, one guy holding one side and the other guy hammering the rivet over.
So you'd literally hammer to mushroom the other end?
Yeah, and then to upset it.
Okay.
Yeah, and create the domed head on the other side with a special tool and a hammer. Mm-hmm. And so I had that rivet forge. I remember when I think I paid $100 for it. And the guy said, "What are you going to do with this? Put flowers in it in your garden?" And mm-hmm. I said, "No, I'm going to put coal in it and mm-hmm. forge something."
Right.
And he was pretty impressed. Like he helped me carry it to the car at that point, I think. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
And that was the beginning of actually blacksmithing.
Mm-hmm. And then you, after that, if I remember correctly, you were at St. Marie Among the Hurons, which is sort of like its own kind of pioneer village,
like
on the location that talked about where the old mission was, where the Hurons were with St. John the Baptist, was it?
Or? Oh, I don't remember all the details, but I'm trying to think of the name here. They're missionaries that were there.
Right. I think it was Bray Buff. He wrote that first Canadian song, "Was in the Moon of Winter Time." You know that song?
No.
"When all the birds had fled." It's like the first ever Christmas carol written in Canada.
Really?
It was written at St. Marie Among the Hurons.
Okay. I didn't know that.
So I just wanted to take a second out of this video to tell you a little bit about
Surfshark, which is a VPN. As someone who's always on the go, whether I'm out in the wilderness or connecting with you online, staying secure and protected while I'm online is paramount for me. Not only does it safeguard my privacy and keep my online activity secure, and a lot of the time these free apps that we sign up to are also taking our information, and most of them don't have ill intentions for you. However, if there's a security breach, some of that information might get stolen. Surfshark also helps me unlock geo-restricted content while I'm traveling, which is kind of amazing. So whether I'm booking flights for my next adventure, snagging the best deals online for gear, or streaming my favorite shows from anywhere in the world, Surfshark VPN has got me covered. As anybody who watches my adventure videos, you probably know that I'm no stranger to unconventional solutions in the wild, and Surfshark VPN fits right into that mold. It's sort of like adding another survival tool only in my digital survival kit. So here's the kicker. By using the code JimBaird, you'll get an exclusive deal for an extra 3 months free at Surfshark. And hey, with a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee, why not give it a try? I mean, it's a no-brainer to me. Remember to secure your privacy and unlock exclusive benefits. Enter coupon code JimBaird and check the link in the description below for more details. Whether you're exploring the great outdoors or navigating the digital landscape, remember to stay safe and secure. And always keep adventuring with Surfshark VPN.
So you were there.
I was there, yeah. And there's a blacksmith shop there. And of course, times have changed. They can't afford to have a real blacksmith. Mm-hmm. And so I let myself into the blacksmithing shop, you know, lifted up the rope, the silk rope that wouldn't let you pass a certain point, started picking things up and looking at it. And I kept seeing my last name on these tools, Johnston. And the stamp was obviously handmade because the N was backwards. And I think the T was upside down. And so I was like, who's this Johnston guy? Like, you know, 200 years ago, this guy was making stuff around here. Like, I got to find out more about that. Mm-hmm. So I looked him up, and turns out he's the president of the Ontario Artist Blacksmith Association, still alive, older gentleman. He's in his 70s, and his name's Lloyd. And we joke that we're cousins because we have the same last name. Mm-hmm. And it turns out he was probably the blacksmith at the Pioneer Village when I was a kid.
No kidding.
Yeah, I was probably him who made the nail.
So you're sitting there watching this enthralled, probably, I'm not going to lie, I remember going to see the blacksmithing at Pioneer Village, which I was devastated when I found out that it was all a lie. No, okay. So, and it's actually embarrassingly old. So this is like in basically the city of Toronto, right?
Yep.
Well, what would be Toronto now?
I think it's on Steeles, isn't it? It's up in the north end of Toronto.
Right.
It would have been like north of Toronto at that, when it was made.
Yeah. But it was, so it's a collection of legitimate Pioneer buildings all brought together into an area to then resemble an actual Pioneer Village.
Right.
I had thought until I was like, I'm not going to say 20 because that wouldn't be true, but it would be funnier at my own expense, that it was actually like a legitimate intact Pioneer Village, which wouldn't really be
people
a place.
Just never grew up. Yeah. They just stayed in the 1700s.
Not the reenactors. I meant, no. The buildings, but, and so you're watching, so you're sitting there, you're probably one of the only kids that's like, I really want to do that. Like, how cool is that? Everybody's told, this is what people used to do. And clearly there's still a guy doing that. And then that was the same guy that years later you ended up connecting with.
I connected with him. I was already blacksmithing at that point. Uh-huh. But then when I saw my last name on some pieces of steel, I was like, who's this guy? Am I related to this guy? So we're not really related, I don't think. I have a pretty good idea as to when my family came to Canada and how they got here and whatnot. What? And our paths probably don't cross other than maybe somewhere in Scotland or Ireland. We had some common ancestor probably, but
That's cool. So you remember when your family came to Canada or North America or?
I'd be guessing. I'd be wrong probably if I guessed, but I think it was mid-1800s.
Mid-1830s. 1830s is when they actually built the first steam-powered ships. So they didn't have to sail here. They could just go in a straight line. And I think one went to New Brunswick and one went to Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Two different stops. So that was like the biggest influx in you know, immigration to Canada. So a lot of people came over here from our, and then of course, I think 1830s was maybe the potato famine too.
Yeah. So why, yeah. My family would be Scottish by way of Ireland. And
yeah, same here. Yeah.
And came in the early to mid 1800s, if I recall, and ended up in Toronto. And
mm-hmm. No kidding. And then basically you just became a pioneer again.
Sort of, yeah. That's awesome. I've always liked working with my hands. I grew up, my grandfather was always working with his hands. He was a plumber. Mm. He built our cottage. He built everything. He was in his 70s, and I remember helping build a dock. And how old was I? I was probably like 14 or something. And he was carrying like 10 2x4s on his shoulder down to the lake. I could manage 3 or 4, and he could carry them twice as many as me. Mm-hmm. And just a hardworking guy, you know, big hands. And so I always like to work with my hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And you just learned that from your grandfather.
My grandfather, my dad a little bit. My other two uncles, not so much. Mm-hmm. One's a minister. The other one was a psychologist. Mm. And working with my hands was how I grew up.
Probably a pretty good round of one guy teaches me moral, the other guy teaches you not to be crazy, the other one teaches you to work with your hands.
There you go, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
We had all bases covered.
Right, yeah. So that's pretty interesting. Yeah, do you think that that's something that you see less nowadays? Because I feel like I grew up when my dad was building a lot of stuff. Like some of my first memories of my dad are him just like carrying logs over his shoulder that he fell with an axe in the woods to go build cribs for a dock and build, you know, just all this kind of stuff. I always remember there's something being built, and he didn't have a background in it. He didn't go to school for it. Mm-hmm. You know, him and his dad built our family camp, which is completely off grid. I don't think he's ever really even used a power tool, and he knows how to saw with both hands saw equally as well. Like all the screws that he put in were like this, right? And I just remember asking him one time, like, Dad, how do you learn how to build things so well? And he's like, well, it's just all about like really thinking hard about what will make it really secure. And that's it. That's like the only lesson other than giving me a box of nails and a hammer and telling me to beat it into the stump. So I always win on the like, how many hits can you get a nail in sort of thing, if they even do that anymore.
Actually, I know some blacksmiths that actually trained. I remember listening to a podcast actually, and it was a woman in the States. I don't remember her name, but she was saying that she hammered nails to get that strength, to build a strength in the arm. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much strength involved with blacksmithing actually. Mm-hmm. I think it's more to do with timing and
more of a, I mean, art can take strength, I suppose, but I guess it's more of an art than a brute force thing, I suppose.
Yeah, it's timing and control, and sometimes you need brute force. And
Yeah, I watched a few things. So as you know, I hope you still know, but I'm at your house watching you blacksmith different things. And the process is really cool. I think it's something that we have. Everything just is kind of manufactured and kind of stamped out as all the same. Everything you make is completely unique in and of itself. And a lot of people have probably seen the Hudson Bay axe that you made for me, and also tweaked to almost customize it for me. And that so much more goes into it than I think most people realize. But can you tell me a little bit about that blank? Because that was one of the really cool things I saw at your place. I remember my buddy, the first time I was there, my buddy Kyle just thought it was like, it was such a highlight for him, just going to your shop, especially after paddling there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we kind of dropped the whole traditional thing after Tori picked me up in the Dodge Ram, but I didn't want to go back up river like people would have done at one time, right?
Pull your way back.
Yeah. But what's the story behind that? The original?
The artifact. Yes. So, I've probably done a couple hundred tomahawks out of rail spikes. Mm-hmm. And a gentleman from Quebec contacted me, said he wanted one, but he wanted it with a fleur-de-lis on the head of the rail spike. So I chiseled the fleur-de-lis into the back of the rail spike. It's one of the few, I've done like a Maltese cross, almost like the Templar cross on the back of a rail spike. And I've done the fleur-de-lis on the back, both of them chiseled out and really time consuming and nothing I would ever offer for sale generally, because a lot of these things, including your axe, they're not really lucrative because there's so many hours going to making them that my hourly rate would be pennies.
Right.
To sell it at anything anybody would ever consider paying for it. So, anyways, he said, well, what do I owe you? And he had already shown me pictures of his axe collection. And I said, would you ever part with any of your axes that he'd found? I guess he has a metal detector. He goes around and finds these things. And he said, yeah, pick what you want. So I said, well, that one there, I pointed to, or I circled it actually, you know, with paint, Microsoft Paint or something. I circled it, sent it back to him in an email. And so he sent it to me. He sent me a Biscayne axe and he sent me the Hudson's Bay axe, which was sharpened beyond, you know, way beyond it was ever intended to be sharpened.
And I had where did he find this? So this is an old axe head, right?
An axe head. And he found it on, and I don't understand exactly where he found it, but he told me on the shore of Lake Abitibi. But my understanding is that Lake Abitibi is a man-made lake, part of the hydroelectric dam.
So the story? I'm singing, am I about to sing another song here? You know the song, Black Fly, the little black fly, always a black fly, no matter where you go. Never heard of that one?
No.
It's by Wade Hemsworth. It's a famous Canadian folk song, and that talks about a guy getting, I think during the Great Depression, getting work to build the dam up on the Little Abitibi River.
Okay.
So maybe, you know, so potentially that's the river.
So there was a Hudson's Bay fort there.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not 100% sure that Lake Abitibi is completely a dammed lake.
Okay.
But it would, if it is dammed, if it was a lake and then was dammed, yeah, most of those artifacts or those things, you know, how much of just cool artifacts in First Nations history is underwater.
Underwater, yeah.
You know? But it could very well be on the Abitibi or Little Abitibi River.
Possibly, yeah.
Above or below the lake.
Right.
Where would be like a prime spot to find something like that. Because the Hudson's Bay axe is a shape essentially of axe head and the size of axe. It's bigger than a hatchet, but smaller than an axe. And it was traded heavily at, you don't agree with me there?
Well, I'll tell you my thoughts on it after you finish your...
Well, you know, good. That's why you're here. and I'm sure you're right.
Well, there's no real document. Like I've tried to find it. I've looked up the history of that axe. So all I can do is look at old axes and say, well, it looks like they were copying this. It was like an evolution of the Biscayne axe, which was the axe that the missionaries brought probably to St. Marie among the Hurons.
Interesting.
And traded with the natives for furs. And it was part of their like token they would give them would be an axe head. And of course that was something pretty special to them because up until that time that they got metal axes, they were using stone or bone. So it would have been a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it's just an interesting style of head too, because you can kind of choke up on the head, get your hand almost behind the bit and do smaller, you know, woodworking stuff kind of with it. And it was, you know, that's what the Voyageurs carried in the fur trade era and the Hudson Bay Company traded at Hudson Bay Post. So I just thought it was so cool, your story behind where this old, you know, sharpened down to the point where it was literally probably discarded.
Yep.
You know, just how much were these people using their axes, which blows me away.
Well, it would have been like if you were going to travel by canoe, which you do, and you had to carry useful things, there's no room even today when you go on a trip, there's no room in your canoe for other than your camera gear, which obviously you need, but I mean, nobody would ever think of carrying all that extra weight with them. So it has to be meaningful, whatever you bring with you.
Right.
And if you're striking out on the land to build a homestead in the middle of nowhere and you're bringing everything with you, either on your back, in your toboggan or in your canoe, every pound counts. So they probably brought an axe head, probably no handle. And an axe would have been part of their essential tools.
And just to... there's just something so cool, so almost connecting with the past to me about that. Right. So here I'm, and just for anybody that's seen the video too, I'm obviously using a canoe with modern materials and all that kind of, you live off grid, which I want to talk about as well, but you know, you have solar panels, right? These kinds of things, but you know, still going there, meeting a blacksmith. Well, I'd already met you before, but meeting up with a blacksmith and you forging or making me an axe that is a model exactly off of one. Like you literally basically traced that old axe
head
that was found
in
with a metal detector on the Little Abitibi River or whatever. And then made me that in probably by the exact same means as it was made. How many years ago do you think?
That axe?
Yeah.
That axe would be 1700, late 1700s.
Yeah, 1700. So how many years
like
ago?
Like early 1800s, maybe.
Yeah, so that's
so
what?
250 years old.
Yeah. So it's almost like resurrecting that past. And then I go and I take that with me and travel in similar ways. And
travel
similar,
the same paths.
Right, bodies the same of water. Paths. Like, isn't that, what is it about that that's cool?
Everything about that's cool.
Right.
Yeah. Even the handle of the axe, right? Like the... a local guy in Parry Sound gifted me some handles that his uncle made. And I started doing a bit of research and there's a book called Logging Days of Parry Sound.
Okay.
And his uncle's mentioned and his uncle passed away in 1960 something. So he passed away before I was even born. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman gifted me three handles that his uncle had made by hand. And the handles are similar to the one that I made for you. Mm-hmm. I tried to emulate them, right? Like these guys swung an axe for a living.
Right.
They knew what worked, what didn't work. They knew what was important. And so Hudson's Bay Axe and the way that handle is, these are all time-tested things. I see sometimes people online talk about the Hudson's Bay Axe design not being ideal. And, you know, the bushcrafting community probably steer you towards a Grand Force Brooks Axe, which I have one. They're great axes. But they don't do everything well. They only do like a Grand Force Brook Axe doesn't even split firewood well because it's so fine, so narrow. It's good for felling a small tree. It's very sharp and good at carving, and it's obviously made of amazing quality steel, modern steel. But it doesn't do everything well, and the Hudson's Bay Axe does everything well enough that it can
sort
be
of like
one,
the Prospector Canoe of Axes.
Yes, it's just like the Prospector Canoe of Axes.
Which is funny because I use it with my Prospector Canoe. When you mentioned that axe handle, that is really interesting because I was like, you know, Chris, can we swap out this axe handle? Because let's be honest, you made that axe to the spec of the Voyageurs who were, you know, probably could have carried me, you know, 10 miles on their shoulders, but were like 5'4".
Right.
On average. Of course, there was one guy that was 5'5". So the odd guy was 6'5", the odd guy. Yeah, like the odd one was huge. But they usually wanted these smaller, stockier people because their legs didn't take up so much room in the canoes, right? So that was one thing that we had to tweak for someone my size is a longer handle. The difference in that handle length, right? From just to get that head speed, it's almost kind of like a golf, centrifugal force of the longer handle, making that head move and it faster and just creating so much more speed with less effort. And then I really loved the bottom of the handle, but I felt bad because I didn't realize you're going to carve the whole freaking thing out of a hickory board.
Yeah.
I thought you at least had a blank. I was like, oh man,
the first handle was ash. And, that's a traditional handle material, especially around here because we don't have hickory.
Right.
But after I saw the axe when you gave it back to me, and the handle was already, you'd already had a few overstrikes and ash just doesn't take it that
way. Or overstrikes are also often what I'm doing is I'm chopping into the piece of wood. And then I'm, you know, a lot of people will keep trying to chop through the piece of wood after the axe head is stuck. Well, I turn it upside down and then I hit the axe on the butt. But then what happens is when it's split, the
it
piece
the
comes
handle.
Down and hits the handle.
Yep.
So I wonder if that was a thing people didn't used to do because to save the handles of ash.
I've got pictures somewhere of axe handles locally, axes with the handles still on them, hanging on a guy's shed. And I took some pictures of them. If I'd known we would talk about them, I might've brought a picture of it. But these axes, the toe of the axe or the front of the blade, the top of the blade, worn completely away because they were hacking at stumps.
Right.
You know, these were farmers. They were cutting stumps out of the ground with these axes.
So they're smoking rocks or hitting dirt.
Yeah. And the overstrike, the handle was chewed halfway through from the overstrikes. And people use their tools until they couldn't use them anymore. Like the axe from Abitibi. As soon
as it starts getting wet too, the handle from the overstrikes, as you call it, and it starts getting wet, it starts getting soft.
Right.
Even hickory, it starts to
Hickory's to come apart. Probably the toughest. Yeah. Handle wood, it is the toughest of all the woods. We could have used ironwood maybe, but it's hard to find an ironwood tree big enough.
I hear ironwood's actually not the best. I would think it was the best, but something about the grains in it being too wide.
It's got a real tangled grain.
Yeah. Have you ever worked with it before?
I've not made an axe handle out of ironwood, but maybe I will. Yeah. One of the handles I got that was from the logging days here. One of them is an ironwood handle,
okay,
and it looks great.
So I just heard somebody say this. I don't have any experience with it.
They used to make the axles for the guns in the First World War. Mm-hmm. So the big artillery guns, the axle that went underneath it so they could tow it behind a horse and a carriage,
right,
was made of ironwood.
You know, it's funny because those trees always seem to grow so straight too, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if that had something to do with it as well. They always grow like they
straight
are.
Straight and
strong. It's just like perfect axles growing in the woods.
Yeah.
They're straight. They never get much bigger than this.
No. Yeah. And it's hard to find a 6-inch ironwood tree is probably the biggest you can find easily.
Is that the same thing as hop hornbeam?
It is.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I guess you learn a lot more about all these things through blacksmithing, about different types of wood. And it's funny because that's different than metal, but you seem to have a good knowledge of different types of wood. Is that just because of axe handles or is that because of your other experiences living off grid and stuff like that?
Well, I think even just up until I was, say, in my 40s, I was clueless. I couldn't tell you. I remember knowing what a maple tree was because the branches come off opposite one another. You can look up at the canopy and you can see it's a maple tree if it doesn't have leaves on it. Mm-hmm. And you can see that the branches oppose one another.
The main ones, they go like this and then like this.
No, they're not staggered. They come out, come out opposite one another.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. And so
you passed the test.
Okay. But other than that, I didn't really know the trees. And now I found that, just being closer to the land, you know, I'll go for a walk and I sort of make a point of knowing what things are, learning what they are.
Right.
And so, my knowledge of trees has changed a lot in the last 10 years.
Yeah. I remember the first few nature walks I went on with my now wife, Tori, so she couldn't have been that annoyed. But I'd be like, this is this kind of tree. And I think she almost thought like I was asking her like questions. I knew she didn't know the answer to her to make her feel dumb or something like that. But then she realized I was just like a total dork. And she's like, okay, I'll let this go by. You know what I mean? Because nobody likes to have a bunch of things explained to her. But I'm the kind of the same way when it comes to identifying trees, you know, what they're good for, what they're not good for, you know, different uses of the wood, all these kinds of things. It's all sort of, it's part of the part and parcel with all the other kinds of things that I'm interested in, I guess, if you know what I mean.
It's all interrelated.
Yeah. And this is only kind of, blacksmithing is only sort of one part of sort of your lifestyle now. You know, you used to work at almost a corporate job, wasn't it?
They called me a process engineer. Uh-huh. I know when they hired me, the HR lady asked me for my engineering degree. And I said, I don't know how to operate a train. I'm not an engineer. And she said, well, it says on your business card that you're a process engineer. I said, well, that's what you called me. I'm a tool and die maker by trade. And so I understand the processes involved with specifically automotive stuff. And so I basically manage the building of equipment and launching of equipment and plants. Mm-hmm. And I worked for Magna for a number of years.
Okay. Yeah. Magna. That's a fairly big business.
It's a pretty big.
So tool and die. So when people, I think a lot of people don't know, I obviously know what it is, but a lot of people don't understand what a die is. Is that just like the things that you use to put stringers onto screws? Like that's a die kit, or what's a die when you respect with tool and die?
Well, in so I said earlier that it's all interrelated, you know, back to blacksmithing. Mm-hmm. So in the simplest form, the hammer and the anvil are a tool and a die. Okay. And I have a hammer that has a flat face on one side and a round face on the other. It's called a rounding hammer. Mm-hmm. And my friend Lloyd Johnston, he's not a real big fan of it, rounding hammers, because it's a farrier's tool. It's not a blacksmith's tool. So
interesting.
I got used to using it anyways, and I like it. And
farrier's just a horse.
Farrier's generally a blacksmith that only makes horseshoes and deals with horses. And there were all different divisions of blacksmithing mm-hmm. back in the day. And now we say, oh, you're a blacksmith. Well, that's like me saying I'm a tool and die maker. But I don't know the first thing about a lot of facets of tool and die.
You'd have a guy that specialized in samurai swords and another guy that specialized in horseshoes, right?
Exactly. That's taking it from two extremes for sure. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, the die is the round die of the hammer is the round side of the hammer. Ah. And so when you hit your work with that hammer, it conforms to the die. And
Okay. So that is essentially why it's called a die kit, that you use to, is it not? So when you have a piece of a metal rod,
yep.
and you want to put, you want to turn it into a screw.
Right.
You take a die kit, you find the right size for the metal rod, and you twist that.
Well, there's not, you don't go to Walmart to buy a die kit for that. No, screws are made through a process called upsetting. Again, a uh-huh. blacksmithing term. Upsetting means to take material and push it back on itself.
Well, I have used a kit to essentially make, I forget, it was a contractor I was working with when I did some construction work. And we actually could make, what are they called? No, I want to call it the screw. What are the little lines called in a screw? The little
thread,
threads. Mm-hmm. The threads are usually where it goes in. But anyways, basically, essentially turning a metal rod into a screw, so you can actually buy.
Yeah. Okay. Thing so that's those called are a those die are dies. Kit. Yep. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't sure where you're going with that. So mm-hmm. I have some of those tools in my toolbox still. So you have taps and you have dies. So the tap will put threads on it on an internal hole,
yeah.
and a die will put threads on a rod. And you can go to the hardware store and buy those things. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, you don't make your own fasteners anymore. It's just not something that's
nobody
done.
Does it.
No. But in the 1800s or the 1700s, mm-hmm. If you needed a fastener, whether it be mm-hmm. a nail or a bolt, with a nut and a washer, you went to the local blacksmith and he made it for you.
Cool. Yeah. 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 And would have been, I imagine, way more expensive comparatively that.
Well, it'd be a lot cheaper than getting on your horse and going 100 miles by horseback and then taking a boat or a train mm-hmm. to Toronto to get some nut and bolt.
Right.
So, that's for sure. Yeah. And certainly there weren't, in the beginning, at least there weren't hardware stores in the local mm-hmm. village that carried these things. I'm sure mm-hmm. that there were common things that they brought in en masse, but if you needed something specific on a logging camp in the bush, if something broke, the blacksmith had to make it.
Mm-hmm. So they had a blacksmith oftentimes on staff.
Always.
Just yes. doing all kinds of things.
There. Sharpening axes. They were working all night while the loggers were sleeping.
Yeah.
They were working to make sure the next day they were able to continue.
Yeah. That must be so cool, because we hear a lot about, people getting back into some of these sort of self-sufficient things. We become so reliant on the ideas of other people, right? Like we talk about modern technology and all these amazing things that we have, but your average person didn't invent those things. We just learn how to operate them. Mm-hmm. So,
sometimes we don't even... we don't know how to operate them.
Well,
back to cars. Like that's why I drive a 25-year-old car. That's my new car.
Uh-huh.
'Cause I understand the technology and I don't need to take it to a mechanic to get it fixed.
Right.
For the most part, I can fix it myself.
Yeah. You don't have to plug it into a computer.
It has a computer, that one does. But I like old stuff because of that. Because I understand how it operates fundamentally. I can take it, I could strip it right down. Mm-hmm. I have a tractor that I use to keep my road open in the winter. Needed to put a head gasket in the tractor. Well, guess what? Did it myself. Took the head off and replaced the head gasket.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And you know how to do that because it's not, the engines are more simpler. The parts are more simpler. And you can man, there's so much you can do as a blacksmith. You can almost do anything. You don't have to, you can make specific tools. You can make customized tools. If you think, oh, geez, I could really use something like, I don't know, like this or that, you can just go in there and make it, as opposed to trying to source it and find it on Amazon or something like that.
Yeah.
It must be a pretty cool thing to just have a pretty cool asset just for, you know, regular week to week, day to day tasks. Probably a lot of people don't really realize that, but this is kind of what I'm getting through listening to you here. You know,
I remember when I was building my house, the contractor was there and he called me and he said, well, we reused the tractor to clear the driveway so they could get their truck in and out. And, but the chain broke on the snowblower.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
So I showed up the next day and I looked at it and I said, okay, we need to make a master link. So I actually made a pin to pin the chain back together.
Oh, okay.
And peened it over and put it together and got it running for him.
Yeah, nice.
And he was like, I didn't expect to see you like fix the chain. I thought you were going to come with like
a new chain.
I'm like, well, I didn't know what size chain it was. Right. I didn't know. I would have just been guessing.
Yeah.
How much did I need? What size was it? What was the pitch of the chain? You know,
yeah.
I couldn't even go buy a master link for the chain because I didn't know what it was. And he wasn't familiar with that stuff. So he couldn't tell me either. Yeah. So when I got there, I could have just picked the size of the chain, jumped back in my car and drove to, you know, 2 hours away would be the closest place to drive that would have had something for me, maybe. And, or I could have just fixed it.
And then you get the wrong thing to go back, realize it doesn't work, drive back to the place, all, you know, all pissed off.
I had it fixed before I would have even got to the store.
Right. Right.
Just by making it.
Yeah. That's pretty. So it's efficient. It's a lot more efficient. It is a lot more
efficient. Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. And at what point, and so you're at this point, you have these skills. So you had some blacksmithing. You never really got into it until somewhat recently, though. You never really.
2016 is when I started heating metal in a coal forge, hitting it with a hammer on an anvil. Yeah. Before that, I was around tools and dies that did things, in some case, hot formed, big stuff, in some cases, truck axles. And so I understand how metal moves.
Yeah, but that's impressive though that you've managed to become to hone your skill as much as you have. Like I've seen some of the comments on my YouTube videos from other people that know a thing or two about blacksmithing or has done it themselves that were, you know, comment on your ability of it's really an art and it's really this and that. So it's just impressive that you've managed to start something and then make a business out of it too, which is not the thing your average person would think is a viable business path is to be a blacksmith nowadays, but you're pumping out all kinds of cool stuff, man. And by the way, thank you for your contribution to the fundraiser that my wife Tori's putting together, Camp_for a Cure. They're originally trying to raise money for the FOXG1 Research Foundation, which is the rare syndrome that our son Wesley has. But this year they're doing it to make, to fund an accessible playground for a local school. And you wouldn't believe how much an accessible playground costs to build.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, yeah. And I just saw what you with it's what it's kind of like a set of hooks, right? But they have like
it's a key rack.
A key rack. Yeah, but it's got like fleur-de-lis on the end.
Well, that was the latest video I just did my YouTube video. Okay, I did show at the beginning of that video the one that I put in the auction for Camp for a Cure.
Okay.
And that one's a canoe. I thought the canoe fit your...
Okay. I must've been getting mixed up because I watched a little bit of that video.
Did you?
Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. You have a YouTube channel as
C. Johnston Blacksmith. Yeah.
And it's a lot of stuff too, that actually just shows you working. So for people that are interested in the process,
it's niche, right? Not like being a blacksmith is a niche.
Save your trip to Pioneer Village and you can tune into your YouTube channel, or if people are interested in getting into it, they could watch that too, right?
Yeah. I try to do projects that are obtainable. Like I don't do anything too complicated. And nothing about blacksmithing itself is all that complicated. Projects get bigger, but they're always made up of small steps. And those small steps can make one small thing, or they can be a small part of a very large project. So some people think, oh, you never made something like that gate or railing or whatever. Okay, I didn't. But I understand the small details that go into making that.
Right.
The problem with those big projects like that is who's going to pay for them, right? Like who's going to pay, who's going to pay you to make a $10,000 gazebo for their porch? Probably almost nobody, right?
Maybe you should go down to Huntsville.
Yeah.
Some of those.
I've tried the markets in the local market and then somebody said, well, it's the wrong demographic. You should go to Rosso. You should go down there in the Muskokas where they got all the money.
Yeah.
And I found it's the same. It's the same clientele. People treat those markets like it's a dollar store. Uh-huh. They don't appreciate the time and skill it takes to make something.
Yeah. It's a unique buyer you'll need to find. Yeah. For like that.
You can go to Canadian Tire or Walmart and buy an axe for $25.
Yeah. But they're not even remotely as cool.
They're not.
I know you don't want to sell axes because it's like way too much work and I'm just pumping these axes, but man, this axe is, it's not just a custom one of a kind axe that is even customized. It's one that's modeled after a head that was found on, you know, in Northern Ontario on an old fur trade route, right? Like how are you going to get that kind of a story?
Right.
Built into this axe that you're using, right? Like, and for the kind of people I think that appreciate that, and that's why I think some of these things are a unique buyer that wants to pay what is okay with paying, you know, what your axe that you would make is really worth, right? But most people, they're just going to, you know, go down to Home Hardware and buy something that's cheap.
Yeah, I've had people pick them up at the market, ask me, how much is this axe?
Yeah.
And I tell them and they put it back down and they're like offended that I told them. And I'm like, it won't hurt my feelings if you go buy an axe at Walmart. It's fine. Go for it. I said, but, you know, that took, like your axe probably took 20 hours to make.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. And with me too, the other thing is it's not all about a price. It's about value, right? So you can buy a Grand Forks Burke axe. I wouldn't buy one of those personally, not to throw them under the bus or anything.
No.
I'd buy the, you know, something I found at Canadian Tire with a good wooden handle, right? But I wouldn't, but I would buy your axe. Right. You know, so it's the value. I feel like I'm getting way more value out of buying your axe than a really expensive, you know, larger scale production axe.
I would say that they're somewhere in between.
Yeah.
Like, so you have your box store axe that's made probably in China, with a wooden handle. Or maybe it's got a fiberglass handle, right?
Those are terrible.
They're terrible.
They don't even cut. The handle just bends and the axe bit doesn't even go into what you're cutting.
Well, it's about geometry. And you could sharpen one of those to make it a useful tool.
Yeah.
Or I could sharpen it for you if you want. I'll show you how to sharpen it.
I just whipped all those in the river.
Then you got Grand Force Brook and they advertise it as a hand-forged axe. Well, okay, as a blacksmith, I can tell you it's not really hand-forged. There's they call him a blacksmith. He's a machine operator. There are dies, multiple dies in a row, and they manipulate the tool through those dies as the machine cycles, and they come out with something that they then go over to the belt grinder and they grind it into shape and they put it on a handle. It's a pretty automated process, and that's why their prices are lower than my price on an axe.
But they have to.
They have to because that's my dilemma. I can't make an axe that anybody will buy, because if I charge what I need to charge to cover my hourly rate in the shop,
you're going to lose your ass.
I'll be making pennies an hour.
Yeah.
So, because you can go buy a Grand Force Brook, which is a great axe.
Right.
Or you can go buy a Walmart axe and grind it yourself and still have a okay tool. It's great.
This
it
might be a great reverse psychology sales pitch to get people like, don't buy his axe. You're going to be getting way too good of a deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, watch, you're going to just get flooded with all these axe orders. And you're going to be like, Jim,
I've stopped taking pre-orders on axes. What I'll do now is I'll make something. When it's made, then I'll put it for sale. Other things I don't mind taking pre-orders on, but on axes, it becomes a burden.
Yeah.
Cause I'll have like three orders of axes and I'm like, I realize that's like a week's worth of work. And nothing else can happen while I'm doing that.
Right. Could you make a musket barrel with as a blacksmith?
Lloyd's made musket barrels. Okay. Lloyd knows how to forge weld a musket barrel. That's a pretty specialized thing.
I imagine.
I've never tried to do it, but basically a musket barrel's made out of a piece of flat bar and it's rolled back on itself and it's got a seam that runs the length of the barrel.
Oh.
And that's all forge welded. And forge welding in itself is a skill you have to learn as a blacksmith. learning that skill in itself is say a milestone. Learning to do a flawless seam weld 36, 42 inches long on a musket.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something
advanced,
else.
Advanced, eh?
Yeah. He's got a couple that he's done just as an exercise, right? Yeah. I don't know that he's created a gun from start to finish. He probably has.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not illegal to have, you don't need a PAL to buy a muzzle loader.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So you live off grid and mm-hmm. not, you also live off grid in, you do have road access.
Yep.
But it's not exactly, you know, a main road. It's more off-roading.
I live on a dead end, on a dead end, on a dead end.
And you got right, yeah. right. On a beautiful stretch of river, or a lake-like section.
Yep.
On a gorgeous river system and a log home as well with mm-hmm. a, you know, nice view and all that kind of stuff. You keep chickens. You fix up old vehicles, which... you know, and drive them in style, like the truck that you cruise out here. We'll have to get a selfie in front of that thing. That's a cool ass truck, man. You know, what was it that you're working this corporate job? I think we could fill in like 3 hours just talking about axes with you here, but I'm interested in hearing. Yeah. So you have this, like what sounds like a good paying corporate job.
Yeah.
You know, and things are going good. Why all of a sudden decide I want to be a blacksmith and live in the woods without electricity, you know, or you have electricity, you are in charge. You are man.
I'm in charge.
Exactly.
I'm more reliable than the local grid, by the way.
I imagine so.
Yeah. When everybody else is like out of power, I've never really lost power.
We used to lose power all the time here and for days on end. And then we had a series of back-to-back hammering windstorms mm-hmm. where we lost power, you know, a day, 2 days, 3 days. One time we were out for 5 days in the winter.
Yeah.
And then ever since then, it's been like golden.
All the dead falls down now.
That's what it must have been. Those big storms just blew down everything, just catastrophized the lines. Everything was a gong show.
Yep.
And then all those dead trees are down and we're good to go. We had a winter storm here, I think 3 winters ago now, because this winter's over, where there was 100 kilometer an hour winds. You probably remember that.
You're talking about 2019?
It must have been.
So that was the winter before I came up here 2019. Well, I had the place, but I wasn't finished building at that point. But I do remember that snow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that particular day that they had the 100 kilometer yeah. winds.
Well, 100, I just remember an entire drift on my porch. There was like a blowing out half moon around my shed. It was like the only time I'd ever experienced that was on my Arctic expedition.
Yeah.
By the way, I have this Thursday, I'm coming out with expedition on my Ungava Peninsula trip. Not shot near as well as the stuff I do nowadays, but I added like an hour and a half documentary for my 36-day solo crossing of Arctic Quebec. I don't know if I've ever
told you. Yeah, I saw that one. I saw some of that. Did you? Is that the one you did with the dog?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's Buck. So there's one up I did on Baffin Island with him. And then that was 18 days. This one was like way, way more insane. Probably the craziest thing I've ever done. But anyway, so you are about to, so you have this corporate job and you're like, you know what? I'm going to move up into the woods. How did you learn everything you needed to learn? If you already know it, was there a learning process? How do you make the decision on what you're going to do to get power in your house? Are you going to connect to the grid? Mm-hmm. You know, what would that even look like? And decide that I'm going to be able to, I'm going to follow this passion, this kind of dream of being a blacksmith, when on paper it's not probably as realistic. What made you decide to go for that?
Well, life is short,
mm-hmm.
so I think working in the corporate world was just sort of draining the life out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear the stories about people who retire and then they die 6 months later.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
So I was 49. And I told my boss, hey, listen, I'm going to leave in 3 months. And he was like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I'll just do my blacksmithing. And he was like, you can't do that. You'll never be able to sustain your living or your lifestyle. And you know, part of being a program manager or process engineer was a lot of like figuring out cost benefit analysis of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally just commuting from the place I was renting north of the city while I was building my house up here, between rent and gas and 407 bills, it was costing me $25,000 a year to go to work.
Wow.
So then I was like, then there's my time. So it was an hour and a half each
just
way.
Just to go to work.
3 hours, 3 hours a day, 5 days, 15 hours, 15 hours that you're not getting paid. 15 hours of your life that you don't get paid for. So you start to look at those numbers and then assign a dollar value to those hours, whatever you want, $20 an hour or something. You start to realize that you're working to work. You're working to sustain.
You're spending money. You might as well be making less money than what your paycheck is.
Yeah. Interesting. So I didn't need to make 100% of what I was making. I didn't need to make 50% of what I was making. I needed to scale back my lifestyle and my debt load in order to allow myself to live more simply. But I still live really well. Like, I just don't eat out as much.
Do you miss eating out? I used to live down south too.
I'm disappointed every time I eat out.
I know.
Every time.
Yeah.
Like, I have a smoker on my porch. Yeah. I make steak and you know, baked potatoes, and we put a pretty good meal together, and every time we're like, oh, this is amazing.
The best.
It's the best.
Yeah.
And then you go out somewhere and you're like, yeah, it was just all right.
And it's $70, $100
$110 for a couple to go out. And and I'm like, well, we could go buy some steaks, like really nice steaks, some vegetables, and come home, drink as much wine as we want with dinner because we don't have to worry about driving.
Yeah.
And not even spend the $110.
Yeah, I know.
And eat better.
And also way better for you. You know what's in it.
Yeah.
You know, I found the same thing after I won a loan. Tori and I were living in a really cool spot. We actually had a cabin on the back acreage of this property, but we were in this sort of like, I guess we'll call it transition zone in between Aurora and Newmarket. And, you know, there's like sort of small farms around us, and my neighbor would just get hammered and do donuts in his yard in the middle of the night and stuff like that. And we had like an outhouse and a fire, and it was, you know, most people would consider it to be rural for sure, but we had like a State in Maine, which is like a pretty good chain restaurant, not too far. So I just got off a loan. Just got won all this money. I was starved. And so we were just, and our kitchen was so small. I can't tell you how much money I probably spent eating out. You know what I mean? And I look back at it now, and at the time, it's like, oh man, that was kind of a waste. And it was kind of fun. Don't get me wrong, but now it's just something I don't really miss at all.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I barely even go through it. You know, when you're living closer to that, just convenience, you end up going through these drive-throughs, you're eating junk, spending way more money.
Yep.
You know, me and Tori have been eating venison steaks like every night for the last month, pretty much.
Might as well. Yeah. You know where it came from, right? And you know, there's nothing in it. It's just good food.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, we got, we're in a good hunt, not just right walking distance from my house, this year. Ended up getting a deer that my brother-in-law got, and, what a connection it gives you to the land, to be able to just like harvest from it. I know a lot of people might think like, oh, that's horrible. You know, you're killing this animal, and you know, that you get that sentiment as well, but yeah, just the thankfulness that it gives you to be able to live in a place where you can be, you know, fairly self-sufficient, really. Like, I can go out and, you know, legally, you know, go deer hunting, harvest a deer, have this delicious meat that's lit. You know how much that would cost me? And I'm telling you, these venison steaks, man, they're delicious. You know, would have cost me just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars to be buying that kind of steak. It wouldn't have been near as healthy either.
Well, that's the benefit, you know, you and I have by living, where we live.
Yeah.
And making our own hours, deciding when we work and when we
right.
play or yeah. It's all work though. I mean, it's not easy to live.
Well, technically we're working right now. We're sitting here shooting. You're promoting Adventure Forge. Like we don't probably aren't thinking about it like that, but you know, technically we are. Like,
it's working. Yeah. yeah. But I mean, I can get up in the morning, go up to my shop and you know, 9 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Or you can go at 5 in the morning,
Or I could go at 10 or I could not go.
Right.
And then I could say, geez, it's a nice day. Mm-hmm. And it's deer season and I have a tag. Mm-hmm. Go grab my bow or go grab my rifle mm-hmm. and go for a walk.
And how far do you even have to walk?
2 years ago, I shot a deer 50 feet from my workshop.
Right.
So I don't even have to leave my property.
Yeah, how do you even answer that question? You don't have to go anywhere.
I don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
They come to me.
Yeah. So do you love it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what, and then so, yeah, I guess, and what, was there a time that you thought, okay, this is the life, and obviously you had a background in, you know, something in outdoors. I saw, you know, how to paddle a canoe. Yeah. You have a really nice old Prospector wood canvas canoe. You obviously have a background in outdoor experience and, you know, to want to do this, but when were you like, first of all, when were you like, okay, that's it. I'm going to break away from this, you know, well-paying job and essentially live in the woods. Mm-hmm. And how much of a learning curve was it to get it all figured out when you did do that?
Well, I think it's like I said about building a project out of little things.
Yeah.
And little pieces of knowledge all add up to knowing everything.
Yeah.
And what you don't know, you figure out. Mm-hmm. So, I had a lot of those little pieces in place already.
Yeah.
I did all the electrical, I did the plumbing, you know, somebody else did the assembly of the house.
You did the plumbing, eh? So I guess you did learn a thing or two from your grandfather, or did you have to YouTube all that stuff?
No, I had, I'll tell you, there are some pitfalls when you do that kind of thing. Cause, depending on where you are, you know, there's some areas around here, maybe here is unassumed township, mm-hmm. but where I am, you have to have a building.
No, we're incorporated now, unfortunately.
So they give you grief about, you know, you didn't put enough straps to hang that pipe. You got to have so many per, mm-hmm. so there are a lot of little details that the average person, even if you, everything was sort of technically right, then
unorganized
township. Yeah. Mm. Anyways, it's not all it's cracked up to be because I had to take a couple goes at some stuff because, you know, they, for instance, the built-in smoke detectors in your house, well, it doesn't really fall in anybody's responsibility list. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically like the general contractor cause I'm building the house, even though I have trades coming in and out. I rough the electrical in. The electrical inspector comes. He said everything looks great. So I tell the builders, you go ahead and do the drywall now. Mm-hmm. And the building inspector agreed because I had the electrical inspection. I get all that stuff done. Now I want to get my final inspection done. He comes in. He says, where are your smoke detectors? I show them the smoke detectors. He goes, no, they have to be hardwired in. Hmm. And I'm like, okay, well, how come nobody pointed that out? You know, before we closed all the walls. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, it's not really electrical's responsibility. Hmm. I think it was ultimately probably the building inspector's responsibility.
Yeah, I think I'm going to just guess that the building inspector's communication skills may have been a little bit lacking.
Well, I guess he's used to dealing with people who aren't building their own house. He's used to dealing with contractors who already made this mistake once.
I fell into that exact same situation. And honestly, fortunately, the building inspector here is a good guy and everybody knows him to be one. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, when I failed my my building inspection for like this probably $10,000 in on this subgrade because I had to dig out all the swampy ground and backfill it and then framed it up ready to pour. Mm-hmm. And when I failed that building inspection, you know, I was like, I probably wasn't, you know, so obvious, but I was like pretty pissed. And I went back into my email chain with the building inspector. I'm like, I see where, and I just realized, oh man, like where I was.
He told you something in passing that was supposed to register with you and it didn't.
It just did not. It was even worse than that. It was actually fairly embarrassing, but you know, but to be honest with you, but I could see why he would have thought that I might have known that and I didn't. So in the end, I just had to own it.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, I blew it, man. So, you know, here I am going on over a year. I still don't have I got to get a variance and all this kind of stuff, but yeah, it's, I know the feeling. So did you have to rip all your drywall out?
No. So, they wanted me to run the wiring through the attic. And I'm like, well, they've blown insulation in the attic already.
Oh, no.
So yeah. I ended up doing it through the floors and coming up through the walls. And because I did tongue and groove on all my interior walls, I had very little drywall in my house.
Yeah.
I was able to pop a couple boards out, run the wires, and then push them back in again.
Okay.
So it worked out in the end, but it was still...
It's fairly stressful.
It was just annoying.
Yeah.
More than anything. And then I had to have him come back and
So it's not all sunshine and rainbows. Even you mess stuff up like that sometimes.
All the time. Yeah. Well, that's how I learned everything I do, right? Like, I mean, how many acts, even today, I was looking at my scrap pile. Sometimes I'll grab a short piece of something or other to make something. Mm-hmm. And sitting on my scrap pile, there's four or five axes that I've just put aside because something's not right with them. And I've come back to those and then thought I can salvage this and made something out of it. But a lot of them are not salvageable. Mm-hmm. And I still make those mistakes today.
Mm-hmm. So was there ever a time when like you just, that was it a slow process to realize what you were doing before was somewhat soul sucking? Or was there one key moment where you're like, man, I just got to get up to the woods. Like, was there anything that just inspired you, like a Jim Baird video or?
It was definitely a Jim Baird video, yeah. Well, my partner at the time passed away.
Yeah.
Oh. And that drove home to me
that
life is short.
I didn't know that, Chris. I'm sorry, man.
Yeah. It was difficult at the time. And it really shone a light on what's important.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we watch like say Sean James, you know, you watch his videos and
he was on the show too.
I know he was, he was your first episode.
Yeah.
And I remember watching his videos before it was even about building his cabin and stuff, you know, back early on.
He was paddling and stuff.
Yeah. And he was talking about self-reliance, which is the name of his thing. And I thought, well, that's all well and good, but you know, it's not so easy to just do that. Mm-hmm. It actually is that easy to just do that.
Oh yeah.
I think so. Yeah. And I think you know, don't wait for a life-changing event to push you in that direction. Mm-hmm. Like do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like go now.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you're thinking you want to do, go now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm into sailing and there's some famous sailors and I don't know their name, but their motto was like, go small and go now. Mm-hmm. Like, don't wait till you can afford a 40-foot sailboat to go sailing. Mm-hmm. Go buy a 25-foot sailboat. Go sailing now.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah. Go small and go now. So that's what I did. I backed up my lifestyle a little bit, right? I haven't bought a new car in more than 10 years.
Yeah, buying new cars is a gigantic waste of money, though, isn't it?
It's a waste of money. It's not something I can maintain myself.
Mm-hmm.
They don't last.
Mm-hmm.
They're not built properly. Mm-hmm. They're not built to last.
So in the end, it took guts to make that decision, but in the end, it wasn't as challenging as you thought it was going to be.
No. I mean, it's still a challenge in that sometimes you wish, like I wish I had my salary I had, you know, in 2018.
Right.
That'd be awesome.
Right.
I wish I could have that salary, but I don't wish for the level of stress or time commitment that involved.
You do seem like a pretty chilled guy.
I am pretty laid back. Yeah. I don't get easily emotional about
thing.
I don't get upset easily.
Yeah. I definitely feel like I like that your calmer demeanor. I feel like I get to do all these really cool things, but I also feel like I'm super busy a lot of the time too, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's my own fault or if it's out of necessity or if I just keep
You have a drive to do it. Yeah. But it is I think it's important to be kind of like able to step back and away from things and kind of think about stuff before you react. So, I can't give a great example of that, but I mean, I have another old car that's close to 50 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've been in the middle of nowhere with that car, 20 kilometers from the nearest road and jumped in it and turned the key and nothing happened.
Oh no.
And the guy I was with was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We're 20 kilometers from the road. I can't tow you out of here. Like, what are we going to do? And I'm like, this car has four fuses and one of them's a spare.
Yeah.
This isn't going to take long. We'll figure it out. Sure. It was something, a loose wire, you know, and, you know, it's the ability to just sort of break things down into those small pieces.
Yeah. And it, you know, the other thing too, is that if we all use things for their actual life expectancy, as opposed to learning how to sew or just throwing things out or fixing things up, you know, so many people might throw out a perfectly good vehicle to buy an electric car, let's say. And you know, that's probably better than some other decisions, but at the end of the day, the enormous less of an impact we'll have on, you know, whatever, you know, it is, if it's emissions, if it's just extraction of the earth's resources in general, if we actually use things like that for a long period of time, I'm sure there's exceptions. Man, those simple skills, everyone having those skills would probably make an enormous impact on.
It probably doesn't help the economy impact. Though. It doesn't help the economy.
Does not help the economy. And there is probably why, one of the reasons why.
So it's like, not, if you look at your, if your carbon footprint, because that's what everybody sort of measures, was like a credit card. Mm-hmm. Every time you buy a new car, it's like putting $100,000, 100,000 credits on your credit card because it took that much energy just to create the car you just bought. Doesn't matter how great it is on fuel or the fact that you just plug it into the wall and you drive it for free.
Yeah.
It came with debt already. Yeah. Right. Well, I look at it like, well, my car's 25 years old. That's like five car lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So that's five manufactured cars. That's $500,000 units of debt that it doesn't have. Mm-hmm. So even if it's not as good on fuel.
Yeah.
It's like it's free at this point.
Right.
You know, it's like a
carbon neutral.
It's carbon neutral because it's so old and it's so fixable.
Right. And it's so fixable. Yeah. And then all the little things that it takes to make something like a pickup truck or whatever, all those tiny little things that need to be sourced, extracted from the earth, the raw materials,
moved halfway around the world,
all come together, assembled, like the amount of that, regardless of what it burns to move, is enormous, right? Yeah. And we know that probably all the things that are making an electric vehicle aren't necessarily running off of electricity or whatever. You know what I can't wait for is hydrogen, until we can figure out how to mass produce hydrogen. That's going to be real fun.
I think mass producing hydrogen is not a problem. I think it's the storage of hydrogen.
Is it? Why? Because it goes boom really easily. Oh man, I saw these like hydrogen powered drones. It's like they fly for like 20 hours. They're like this big, you know, they're like super expensive. They're not even available on the market yet, but to do what I'm doing and take my drones, have these high, like it would just be absolutely incredible.
But probably the solution to all that stuff is outside of maybe even anything we've even thought of.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going to say outside of the planet.
Well, that's possible.
Yeah.
But I think that we get stuck in our thinking, right? From a blacksmith, every problem looks like a problem I could solve with a hammer.
Maybe you could,
you know,
maybe you should start blacksmithing some space-based solar, satellites. Hey.
Maybe not. Yeah.
That's the one thing I saw. That is a thing. You can make satellites with solar panels on them that can actually beam using microwave technology or laser technology, the power back to battery receptors on Earth. So that's actually like a thing. You know,
well, I thought the electric cars should be like the slot cars. Remember when we were kids, we had slot car tracks?
Yeah.
They should have a power line on the road.
Yeah.
Then a little arm should come down from the car. Mm-hmm. Maybe not on the side roads, but at least on the major highways.
Yeah.
And power the electric car as it drives. Because the big pitfall of the electric car is its range.
Right.
So if you had that, it could literally be like charging its battery while it's driving down the road.
That'd be cool.
Because they're all self-driving. So they just need to find that thing with their self-driving technology, line it up, and follow it.
Well, could you imagine if there was a break in the line, though? It would really screw things up. Well, not if you could just lift it. Because
they're powered in sections, right? So what if it lost power? You still have a battery in the car.
But the point is, you don't have to use that. You could drive on it, you could drive down your driveway on a back road or whatever. That would be cool. That's a great, a major thing for the infrastructure, but.
Yeah, and when it snowed, it wouldn't work. And there's things all these things, but
yeah, I hate all those things. You know, I there's an interesting thing I heard one time. This is kind of what you're explaining to me. you know, through even just having these old cool, like your truck out there is a classic. That is cool. That's a cool, maybe not everybody would agree with this, but I'm just like, this guy is cool that has that thing. That's, I like that, right?
That's my intermediate age truck.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And, you know, just to be able to fix that up and just, it's just a classic. And I forget what it was, but it was, this is what I, kind of what I think you're explaining. Tell me if I'm wrong, but it's a story about this, you know, wealthy businessman who flies down south to the islands to fish, you know, a couple times a year, if he's lucky, maybe once a year. And he goes out fishing with this local guy, right? And the local guy's like, he's like, you know, the wealthy businessman who's working all the time, he just wants to get out there fishing. That's his happy place, right? Yep. And so he asks the guy, well, how many fish do you catch? Oh, you know, sometimes I catch just enough for my family. Sometimes I catch a bit extra. He says, well, what do you do with the extra? He's like, well, you know, I'll sell some to the local, maybe the local market. And the businessman goes, okay, well, you know, why don't you, you know, use another fishing rod? Well, why would I do that? Well, then, you know, you could catch more fish. Well, why would I want to catch more fish? Well, then you could sell more to the local market. Well, why would I need that? Well, then you could buy a boat.
A bigger boat.
To then catch even more fish and have more fish. Well, then why would I do that? Well, then you could buy another boat and, you know, basically build an entire fishing business.
Yeah.
And eventually the story goes, well, why would I want to do that? It's like, well, so then you could, you know, come fishing on this beach for a week every year.
Yeah.
Where
meanwhile, he wakes up in the morning, goes fishing on that beach every day.
And is living this guy's dream. It's like, what's the point of stressing yourself for all this money when you don't even, what you really want to do doesn't take any money, nearly as much money.
No.
How is that going to make you happier?
It doesn't cost me anything to put a piece of wood on a stump and hit it with an axe.
Right. Yeah.
But I could go to the store and spend $10 on a bag of firewood.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And some people do that, right? They get away for the weekend. They go buy two or three bags of firewood.
Yeah.
They drive 3 hours to get to a campsite to put their canoe in the water for a couple of days.
Right.
And they do that twice a year. And whenever you sit down with those people and talk to them, and I was that person, you sit down and people would say, you know, what do you do besides work? Oh, I love to go canoeing.
Yeah.
I love to go camping. I love to drive off-road in my old Land Rover.
Yeah.
And they would be like, oh, that's amazing. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun. Do you do that? Like, how often do you get to do that? And you think about it, you go, well, I only get to do it once or twice a year.
Right.
Five times a year if you're lucky, right?
Yeah.
With all these different constraints pulling you in all directions, you just can't find the time.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'm at the beach fishing every day.
Yeah. And I look at like, there's all, even doing what I do with creating YouTube content, there's probably all kinds of other things that for sure on paper would be a lot more lucrative. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, how could I possibly, unless I was like a retired surgeon, how could I even if I was making enough money, how could I take the time off work to get to do all these things? Right.
Well, that's what you need to ask yourself. Like ask those people, what are you going to do when you retire?
Right.
And they're going to say, oh, I'm going to go live in a little cabin off grid and cut some firewood, tap some maple trees in the spring, make some maple syrup, go hunting in the fall, get a deer. These are their dreams.
Right.
Some people don't get there. Some people die before they retire. Yeah. Some people die shortly after they retire. They never get to realize those dreams. And I think that's what became apparent to me was like, take it now, take it now.
And also, that's you know, it's brave to do that. It's considered to be for sure brave to do that. But, you know, the other thing is if you wait so long, you know, you're not going to have the strength you do when you're younger, but you're also, there's so much to learn to be able to do that effectively. You can't just be like, oh, I'm going to become an expert whitewater canoeist when I'm 65.
Right.
Like, you know, you don't have enough time to learn it at that point.
So if that's somebody's aspiration is to do what you're doing, you know, three times a year, you go on these big trips and you're absolutely right. They're going to get to that point and then they're going to be like, I'm not physically able to carry my canoe on my pack.
Or I'm never going to be able to do that because it's going to take me 3 or 4 years to get to the point where I could do that without dying.
Right.
And to learn the skills to enjoy it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. How do you like it, by the way? How do you like living off grid and in your place? And did you, was that your intention, or did you do the math and decide it was better and more efficient to not connect to the grid? Cause you'd be quite a ways. Like the deliverage fee is what kills you, right? Like so people that have to get power connected to their house.
Yeah.
It's not the charge of the electricity. It's the extra,
the connection fee
to run it off the grid that kills them.
They told me that, and I believe it was a real estate agent said, oh, I had one client bought a property, not unlike yours, maybe not quite as far from the road as yours. And it cost them $75,000 to bring the power lines to their property.
Wow. Yeah.
So I built my solar system for half that.
Mm-hmm.
Now my batteries are now 5 years old. And I need to replace them because lithium wasn't feasible at the time.
So these are lead acid.
They're lead acid. Yeah. And so they're pretty much done. And so I'm going to have to add another $5,000 to $10,000 to my system again.
Mm-hmm. And that's how much it costs to buy new batteries? Or can you get those ones refurbished?
Even my lead acid batteries would cost close to that. Probably $8,000. Yeah.
Okay. Which isn't really crazy if you consider that you have not paid one hydro bill since you got the place.
Yeah. But the payback time's huge, right? Like, I don't know what an average hydro, cause I haven't paid one. You know, let's say it costs $250 a month for your hydro on average. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Just guessing.
I don't know.
And so.
So I don't have a deliverage fee cause we have the line kind of cuts across our property.
So let's say in 10 years, it's, it's 2,500. So 10 years would be 25,000, 20. I'm rounding things here, but you know, in 10 years you might have paid what I paid for the solar system.
So for me, it doesn't necessarily make sense other than just the awesomeness of
I'm autonomous though, right? I'm, but it doesn't come without work.
Right.
There's been days where I got up in the morning and it's minus 30.
Yeah.
And the generator was supposed to come on.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't because it just wouldn't start because it's propane and it wouldn't start in that cold. And I had to go up and utilize some skills to get it to go. And so
what do you use? I thought you're mostly using the solar though.
I am, but there's no sunlight. I mean, it goes by hours of sunlight, right?
Right.
So in the wintertime, in December, we have very little sunlight up here.
Right.
And the sun never gets high up in the sky.
No.
So, you know, inevitably you rely on a generator to charge your batteries because you can't run your batteries below a certain point. You start to damage them.
Okay.
Right. With lead acid, if they get too low, they'll freeze.
Right. Yeah. 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 Because they don't freeze because there is a sort of a chemical reaction.
Well, the acid doesn't freeze.
The acid. Okay.
Yeah. But once they've discharged, the acid becomes essentially water.
So then what would you do? You'd use lithium then specifically?
I think lithium's the most, I guess that's probably where, because it has longevity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think some of them come with like a 50-year warranty.
And then you can actually refurbish those too, can you? More easily than the lead acid?
Well, the lead acids are refurbished too.
Okay.
Like the people refurbish, like if you can watch videos on YouTube of guys in India taking lead acid batteries apart and rebuilding them and then selling them.
Yeah.
So
I saw a video the other day, which just kind of really blew my mind. I think it was legit, but it was a guy who took a whole bunch of used CDs and then he wrapped copper wire around them going through the hole in the middle, all around it, like kind of almost looked like a star. And then he was actually able to connect those copper wires to light a very small light just off one CD, or is to run like a very tiny little fan.
Right.
So then he took like something like, I don't know, 150, 100 of them, and he laid them all out in a pan and he connected all of them together with wires in a specific way, which I didn't quite catch. And then he poured epoxy over all of them and popped the piece out, and then it was a legit homemade solar panel.
Really?
Yeah, that he was then running. So is that all a solar panel is? It's just like, I know this isn't your area of expertise, but just like sunlight reflecting on something, on a conductor? Like, is it really that simple? Or was I sucked into the bowels of misinformation?
I think it's like one of those perpetual energy machines that you see with no batteries attached and it lights a light bulb and just runs forever.
Apparently that's not real.
I don't know. I'm not sure exactly how the solar panel works, to be honest with you. But
how many watts do you have on your panel?
7,500 watts. of solar.
Yeah. And then so when in the summer, you're good to go with that?
Oh, in the summer, my batteries are fully charged by 11 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Most days. Yeah.
And so then how much battery power, like how many watts?
550 amp hours at 48 volts.
Okay.
I guess with theoretical when it was new.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe 2 or 3 days of power for the house. You were in my house, which you've been in my house, but you don't realize it's off grid. I have a fridge.
Right.
I have a freezer. Mm-hmm. I have a washer. I have a dryer. Yeah. The dryer's gas. The stove is gas.
Do you have a well? The fridge is electric.
I do have a well.
Yeah.
My well's 450 feet deep.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. So what kind of well is it? Dug or is
drilled
it?
Well.
Drilled well. Yeah. Okay. So that's a dug well would be what, like 50-100 feet deep or something like that?
I don't think anybody has a dug well anymore.
Yeah, I guess not, eh? Too bad. Nobody hews logs. Nobody has dug wells anymore. God, you know?
The good old days.
You know, right.
When the cow peed in your well.
Right. I have this really cool, actually back where Tori and I lived, there's something called, I think it's called a kettle lake. So you know what an artesian well is, essentially? It's sort of a well that is like a vertical eddy between the groundwater and the top of the well, we'll call
okay.
it. So we're talking about this lake. I remember hearing all what turned out to be wood frogs that I'd never really heard before, all peeping in here.
Yeah.
And what was like, are those cackling ducks? Is that a freight train idling? What the hell is that? Like,
where was that?
This is just in a huge area that, you know, sadly, there's tons of coyotes, tons of wild turkeys there. It was this large area just behind the property we lived on. There's actually this old freaky little pet cemetery from the 1920s and 30s in the bush there too. And which was just a trip that nobody even believed that it still existed and it got developed over and all this kind of stuff. And I came up and found this kettle lake that had no inflow or outflow to it. This is in the Oak Ridges, Oak Ridges area. And I was like, what? That was so cool. I have a video on it. And I walked up to it and realized the water was really cold and like absolutely crystal clear. And it's obviously just a bastion for, for all these frogs, right? Unfortunately, it's probably bulldozed over and diverted or something now. That's why one of the reasons we got out of there, because all these rural areas just from urban sprawl.
And Doug Ford sold it.
No, it was before that. But yeah. Like, well, I guess the feds came in, I think, closed down his Greenbelt expansion thing, which is kind of crazy because the feds are bringing in endless amounts of new people, and then Ford's like, we need a place to house them and we're gonna have to scrap this green space. And then apparently he had his tentacles in with a bunch of housing, and there was some potentially nefarious kickbacks. And what do you do with that crap shoot? But anyways, so essentially what I called the MNR, I talked about this because, you know, I was just nerding out over it, right? And that's what it was. It's when the groundwater pushes up, so it's seepage from the groundwater, that pond can't get to a certain height before the pressure of the pond itself pushes back down on the seepage spout and then creates a vertical back eddy, just like the draft in a chimney that's replenishing itself with fresh groundwater, right? So that those areas like that are super important, because if they get polluted, that water is eddying back down into the aquifer.
Oh, down to the aquifer.
Okay. Exactly. And into that incredibly delicious and pure groundwater they have in the Oak Ridges area. Yep. That's like filtered by limestone. Our showers, the water tasted so good out of our well there, but the water was so hard that it was like Tori was complaining because she's like, my hair looks like shit. You know what I mean? And it was like, you couldn't even foam. Your hair wouldn't even foam. You'd be like, because it was like mineral water.
Right.
It was like delicious mineral water, right? But anyways, yeah, which is probably loaded with electrolytes. That's one of the things a lot of people that they'll have like a distiller, but there's
no nutrients in it.
Yeah. So if you're drinking just, I kind of didn't connect this, but if I'm out there on a 36 day winter trip, just drinking melted snow, would you think that would have like an electrolyte issue with me? You know what I mean? I don't know why I'm asking you. It's not a blacksmithing related thing, but I feel like you just know the answer.
I don't drink water. I can't drink tap water in the city anymore.
No. I know. It tastes like chlorine, dude.
What is that?
I know. Yeah. It's terrible.
People give you a glass of water at a restaurant. You're like, oh, no thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get my, we got our water here from this spring on Horner Road, which isn't far. Yeah. And it's like, you know, there's a sign from the township, like, this is untested, drink at your own risk. Yeah. But like, I'm like, well, all these people I know, they're doing good and they're not dead. So that's what we drink. And it's live water, right? And it comes right out of the ground, and it's got any bacteria in it you're drinking. It's not just like killed bacteria. So any bacteria that's in there is like positive bacteria. It's supposed to be like just way better for you in all kinds of ways. Well,
it's like when you go to Mexico, they say don't drink the water, but the locals drink it.
Right.
Because their system's already acclimatized to the to the bacteria in the water.
Yeah. Do you drink it? Do you ever drink the river water at your place, or would that be, wouldn't be the best idea.
It doesn't look great. I mean, it's kind of tea colored. I'm sure it's pretty clean though. I mean, the Mag flows right out of Algonquin Park. So there's not a lot of development on the Magnetawan.
Amec has a fair high mercury content.
Does it?
Yeah. Which is, you know, probably too small to detect from drinking the water,
Why would that be? Was that industry?
Well, yeah. So yeah, unfortunately, because, you know, mercury was used in all kinds of things back in the day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're downriver from Amec Lake. So I don't know how much of it would be in the Mag, because there's a certain amount of water that's held in the Mag too. But I think Amec Lake doesn't have the best, you know, rating for how many sport fish you can eat out of it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, you know, it's the aquatic vegetation and plants and helgramites and fish flies and all kinds of things you see just down the rocks down by the river. I have freaking bullfrogs that live like almost in the rapids and snapping turtles here and stuff
I've seen five line skinks at my place.
Oh, cool.
Which is the only lizard in Ontario.
Yeah. That's neat, eh? What, have you ever seen a moose on your property?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
They've swam across the river.
Oh, cool.
Right in front of me.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I've only ever seen the moose poop and prints on my property here.
I was saying to Tori when I got here that the neighbor has 100 acres there with a sugar shack that's like a time capsule. And the moose always winters in there with her calf.
Every year.
Every year.
That's wild.
If I went for a walk, I could almost certainly show you a moose.
No kidding, eh? Yeah. Yeah, and how big is that property?
That one's like a 100-acre property.
Yeah.
So about 1,000 feet of frontage, I think.
Yeah.
I'm guessing.
And what is it about it that you think the moose likes as a wintering spot there?
Well, there's a lot of small trees growing up, because he'd logged it a couple times.
Yeah.
And he logged it like selectively for like the yellow birch for the veneer. And so they didn't clear it. They just went through and picked at it. So you've got a lot of small hardwoods coming up out of the ground that are like chest high. So the moose has a lot of food in there. You know, they like to eat the buds off those trees.
Yes. Yeah. They eat just the sticks. Yeah. Small branches.
You walk through there and you'll see the chewed ends on these little saplings and you'll see moose hair stuck to them.
Oh, cool.
And I know where they like to sit, like where they get some shelter from the wind.
Yeah.
And almost certainly in the wintertime, if I walk in there, the first time I didn't know where the sugar shack was, I thought, oh, there's the sugar shack over there. And I started to walk towards it and it started to walk away. It was a moose.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It was a moose with her calf.
And then you are a blacksmith. You got a sugar shack beside you. I was thinking it'd be cool to start like a local sort of barter thing just for fun. Right.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, my neighbor, we are his best customer for eggs. He's like, yeah, I'm not making any money off of this. Basically, it's a business for his kid to deliver local people eggs for $5 a dozen.
Right.
You know, but I just thought it'd be cool, because me and Tori make maple syrup. We grow a ton of corn and squash. Last year, we had a ton of squash.
Yeah.
Be kind of cool just to get together and sort of act as a bit of a community in a way to share stuff.
For sure.
You know what I mean? Or just get together and shoot the shit.
How many maple syrups do I get for an axe?
Oh man, let me tell you, that would probably be a comparable labor of love, but I'm sure the axe has us beat. But yeah, like, you know, but the thing is that the maple syrup, it's not really expensive, right? Like, you can buy super expensive sugaring stuff and there's no limit to what you can spend, because a lot of the stuff is kind of custom. Right. But what Tori and I did, we bought two of the heavy duty catering trays, which are $30 each. So they're thicker ones.
I copied your design.
Okay. So preaching to the choir here.
Yeah.
I actually ended up putting hardware stainless steel hardware handles in it, which I don't find I really need.
Right.
Because, you know, you're just scooping the sap out of the warming into the next one. So we do use them sometimes, but you could really just kind of grab onto the sides.
Right.
And then we made the, you know, took a barrel stove. So that was, how much did you spend on yours?
Well, I didn't even put a door on mine.
Oh, no.
Or legs. I just prop it up on some rocks okay. when I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
And so I literally went to the dump.
Yeah.
And the dump near me, yeah. there's a guy who throws those barrels out.
Oh, man.
So there's always,
I wish I'd talk to
those
you on
barrels
that
are always there at the yeah. dump near me.
Well, I only paid 10 bucks for mine. I think right. it was full of spray foam insulation. So when we burnt it off, it didn't smell too good.
I think it's probably your barrel came from the same place
no
mine did
kidding.
Then. Yeah. Okay. Because it's a taxidermist who, yeah. it's his foam. Oh, okay. For building the mounts,
oh,
and
no kidding.
He throws those barrels out at the dump.
I bet you that's where it was. So yeah. you got one for free. I paid 10
You just
bucks.
Go to the dump and get them.
I that's could, funny.
You just have to know which dump.
That's wild. Yeah. I paid. Yeah. So 10 bucks for the barrel, but you didn't bother buying the kit. So I bought a stove kit.
Yeah.
Which is just a ring.
They're on Amazon for like 50 bucks or something.
Well, I think I
bucks.
Got ours from Home Depot, but they don't actually stock it.
Okay.
So you have to call and order it from Home Depot.
Right.
So it's just the door, the feet, and a stove ring. You have to find a stove pipe.
It sounds like something a blacksmith could make.
I bet you could. You see my handle, my splitting kindling handle. That's something that would be.
I've actually made one.
Yeah. I can't. It's just like it. A lever. Eh?
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah,
it's
I know
right,
which one
right
you got there.
Yeah. But, you know, you put the wood in and you go like this, and
yep.
then you take your split kindling off of your split wood to get
right.
your fire going because we never have any freaking kindling,
yeah.
right? Yeah.
Much I find process. that works good on softwood. So I always have a little bit of cedar.
Oh, okay.
That I can split up with that, but I made one of those too. Yeah,
that's smart. Yeah, I just use the whatever driest piece of hardwood I can find. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That'd well, not cool. all of us have that kind of like mass behind us to.
Well,
to
notice how mine's bent.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there's like, wow.
anybody else would have given up before they bent it.
Probably. Yeah. All right, get this fire going if it kills me.
Yeah. Lean on it.
Mm-hmm. Would that be something that would be economical to make as a blacksmith, or would that be too
well it's
involved?
It's not really a blacksmith. I mean, the handle I made for mine, I could make that into a blacksmithing project, but the rest of it's more of a fabrication.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you know, I have the equipment in my shop to do it, so yeah, I can
cool.
make some of those.
Yeah, just throwing it out there, old
sure,
buddy,
yeah.
old pal. Even just a new handle, make me. I could probably just buy a new
I
one.
I could probably do something for you. Yeah.
Yeah,
something that looks a little bit more handmade.
Cool. So what's next, Chris? Any aspirations, anything that you're thinking about doing with the, you know, blacksmithing, any cool projects that you're going to do for yourself or other things you're going to offer or et cetera, et cetera. What's next? Or are you just kind of plateauing and you're just going to cruise the way you're going now?
I mean, there's things I like to make. Tomahawks, a little bit smaller version of an axe. That's easier to make.
Mm-hmm.
I do make a few of those still. Fireplace tools.
Mm-hmm.
So generally fire pokers, those are something that people always hit me up for and I can personalize them. And then
nice.
Some smaller things like trivets and.
Well, we made Toria a fire poker last
year,
but an outdoor. So a
yep.
longer one with the raker on
yep.
it.
Yeah.
She loved that, by the way. She uses it for all her paddle like a girl workshops.
Awesome.
For tending to the fire.
You can use that when you're making your maple syrup.
100%. Yeah. And her name's even stamped on it
there
too. Tori's actually the one that does the bulk of the maple sugaring work,
mm-hmm.
you know, once we get it going, but she's like on the ball out there doing it. And you know what I mean? She's like, yeah, at first I thought maybe we were both kind of doing it together, but now she's like definitely the pro.
Taking the lead on it.
I'd say so. Yeah. Yeah. At doing it. Like hopefully we get something. It's freaking going to be warm again.
I think
tonight.
The sap was running like 3 yeah. weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's because it just, the weather's been crazy this year.
Yeah. Well, typically it's when it's cold at night and then warms up during the day.
Mm-hmm.
But when it stays above freezing during the night. So we had that, you know, temperature swing where it was really warm, but then it went back down to minus 20.
Right.
So right now it's probably not running, but then after tonight, it's going to be getting to
cold,
be cold,
warm, cold, warm.
Yeah. Cold at night, warm in the day. So it should
yeah.
start running again. I can't imagine because there's still snow on the ground. So usually by the time it's over, there's no snow and we're just sitting in mud. And at the
yeah.
beginning of the season, we're snowshoeing. Right. So if it stops running, it's going to be somewhat depressing.
Because you just have to go to the store and buy it.
Yeah, I guess, but just like $1 million. Yeah. We love just to get it because people love like homemade maple syrup, right?
Oh, it's
such a cool.
We gave some away last year and made up little stickers with our.
Oh, you guys made your own labels?
Just Vanessa's an artist, so she did the little label, and we stuck that on the bottle with a little bit of packing tape and gave it to a few friends.
Cool. Yeah. How much did you guys make?
Not much, like maybe 5 liters.
Yeah, which most people think that's nothing, but that's not easy.
It was a bit of work. Yeah.
Yeah. That's not easy. So living off grid, obviously a nature lover. You know, I know that you've done some canoeing. I've done a little bit of paddling with you. Where did it all start?
Oh, it's my grandparents' fault, really, I guess, because they had a cottage on Lake of Bays. So I grew up there. I spent every weekend during school, I was there every weekend. And in the summer, I was there for the whole summer.
Where was home for you during the winter?
Toronto area. Yeah, I moved around a little bit, but for the most part, Toronto. But I used to explore even in Toronto. You know, I'd get on my bike, get down to the Hummer River, go fishing. Mm-hmm. Explore crazy stuff too. Like I was wading in the Humber River with like hip waders I borrowed off of. We lived in a duplex and the neighbor below us had stuff in the garage and hip waders and stuff. And I said, "Hey, can I borrow your hip waders?" And he was like, "Sure, take them." Yeah. So I was in the Humber River without a life jacket on in full flood fishing, catching carp or not carp, suckers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was loving it. Yeah. Used to bring home lampreys. You know, put them in my aquarium for a couple of days and then let them go.
That's dark.
And I always loved animals and nature and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, I was at the cottage and had the choice of the rowboat or the canoe. You know, all the privileged kids had a little motorboat that they could tool around in. Mm-hmm. No, my grandfather was like, if you're going to go somewhere, you're going to do it yourself. So you can have the canoe or you can have the rowboat. Mm-hmm. And the canoe was just obvious choice. Like I grew up paddling a canoe.
Yeah.
And then I remember going to Algonquin Park, getting Omar Stringer's book with all the paddle strokes learning, teaching myself those paddle strokes. Mm-hmm.
You read the book and you visualized it and went out there and did it.
Went out there and did it. Well, they were great little books. So you could get them at the visitor center there in Algonquin Park. Mm-hmm. And then Bill Mason, I got all of his books.
Nice.
And, you know, and I wanted to do all these big trips that you do, like as a kid. I remember thinking, I got to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, but life happens and you get stuck doing life and you don't end up doing those things. But
I think you're making up for it though.
Yeah, I'm making
like
up for it.
You moved up north and most people's like dream that you're actually doing it.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I think that's something too that we take for granted as having families that have been in Canada for longer is that you are privileged in the fact that you don't have to come from a wealthy family to have a cottage on Lake of Bays.
No.
You know, like my grand, so I grew up with a family camp or cottage or whatever, water access. My dad built it with his bare hands, no power. We never had electricity up there till I was 3 years old and we're on a CB until I was a teenager. And I spent, you know, tons of time up there. Cost them $600 to buy the land.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then the price of building materials and they didn't care. They just built it at whatever space, you know what I mean? Nowadays, you know, you're talking about an absolute fortune you need to be able to do that kind of stuff, unless it can be passed down in the generations. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that
if you're from
happen.
The city that, you know, if you're from a major urban center, which a lot of Canadians are from, most of us now are from, you know,
my grandparents sold the cottage. My grandfather's health was declining and, you know, he wanted to make sure he was providing for my grandmother after he was gone. And I got told afterwards that they wouldn't have sold the cottage if I hadn't moved out west with my dad. I only lasted like 11 months out west.
Yeah, that probably made you feel great.
I was like, you're kidding. Well, nobody else knew how to run the pump. Nobody else knew how to winterize the cottage. You knew all that stuff. And I was like, now you tell me.
Well,
but in hindsight, I couldn't be on Lake of Bays. I couldn't be in the Muskokas. It's too busy. I call them lake lice. Like they just drive me crazy. I really hate to see them. Mm-hmm. Like it'd be different if they jumped on that thing and went somewhere.
Right.
If but go just on a trip
pointlessly
with it,
ripping
but
around.
But just ripping around circles. Doing donuts and making noise. Like,
I know.
Yeah. You're just disturbing my tranquility.
It just ruins everything. I would agree. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say too. Like where you're living now, you know, how could you, would you still have the Lake of Bays? Like, you know, if it wasn't for some of these bad things happening, you know.
Yeah, one door closes, another one opens.
Right. And some of them might be first world problems too, yeah. Right? Like, but yeah, without that happening, you know, it doesn't, you never get to maybe the kind of stuff you're doing now. You know, I have stories like that too, right? If I had a rough time going through school and never did well in school. Neither and did probably I. did, you know, you too. Eh? Yeah. And that, you know, that isn't exactly a real self-esteem booster.
Right.
You know, luckily I was good in sports and stuff like that too, but like,
I realized and I had people encourage me and say the same thing, is that the school system wasn't designed for me. Mm-hmm. It was designed for, it's a cookie cutter thing, right? And now in hindsight, like, it's all designed to push you into that trap of
what's getting a house, safer,
a mortgage thing, a job, working till you're 65, save money until later in life when you can finally enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a trap.
Well, they say the whole system was structured around the Industrial Revolution, which I'm sure there's probably some truth into too. And it doesn't necessarily fit for everybody.
Henry Ford was a genius, right? Like he almost designed that whole system, and he knew that he was trapping those people.
Also a horrific anti-Semite. We'll just glaze over
that. Well, that's, I think there's certainly a shadow been cast on him for sure. But I mean, I tend to look at the
I don't know the details.
I don't know the details either, but it does seem like he knew people well enough that if he thought, if I make this car affordable, then everybody working at the factory can afford one. Then they can't afford to just take a day off because they got to stay pay their bills.
Yeah, it sounds kind of conniving. Yeah. And it's hard to break out of that, because when you don't fit into a typical system and you're kind of told, hey, something's wrong with you.
Right.
You know, that becomes your own story. So you kind of got to break out of that story, which is part of the challenge of moving on and you know, kind of drawing a line and saying, this is how I'm going to think of myself and this is how I'm going to feel.
Right.
You know what I mean? And have the guts to kind of eventually do what you did, but you were also crushing it in, you know, the corporate world too, before you started doing this.
I did well. Cause I mean, at least I was in a field that was interesting. Mm-hmm. Albeit soul sucking, I think at the end. Yeah, I don't know. I had a thought there, but it disappeared.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're getting up there. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, that's interesting though. The fact that you always had that kind of passion and that connection to the outdoors and, you know, the simple life, of course, which is really not that simple.
That was what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So I remember being in high school. No, it was grade school still. Mm-hmm. And they sent me to the high school to do this, like, you know, I don't know what it was called, but it reminded me of this book I saw once, What Color Is Your Parachute? You know, and it's like, what are you going to do when you grow up?
Right.
And so they sat me down in this room, and there was VHS tapes wall to wall, all different professions. Mm-hmm. And I sat in that room and I watched about 4 hours of trapping.
Oh, no kidding.
They had videos on trapping. And then the woman who was the counselor or whatever she was like, so this is interesting. I'm like, this is, really interesting.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I can see that. You've watched like 4 hours of these videos now. And so then she said, well, what else are you interested in? And then I said, well, I like mechanical things. So they had a lawnmower engine there. And then they were like, well, why don't you show us, here are the tools, here's the engine. Why don't you take some of this apart and then put it back together. So I took it all apart and put it back together again. That was the second half of my day. The first half of my day was trapping.
Wow.
And the second half of my day was mechanical things.
What were these videos? Do you remember?
They were VHS tapes. I think they were like half hour long, but some of them had multiple episodes, let's say.
And you don't remember who produced them or what they were called?
It was at Burnham Thorpe Collegiate. It was, basically, they didn't know what to do with me because I wasn't excelling in the school system. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they said to my mom, well, we think he's got some sort of learning disability because his marks are terrible. And so then they tested me and then they were like, well, actually, this doesn't make any sense at all. Because I did really well on their tests, right? So, and I've always been like that. Like if I have to do a test, I'll sit down and write the exam. I don't even have to read the subject matter in some cases, and I'll do pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
My math teacher challenged me in grade 11. Uh-huh. He said, "You didn't do all the questions in the homework." And I said, "Well, I did three of them, and there was 10, you know." And I said, "I got the idea. Like, I know how to do it." He goes, right. "Well, you know, you say that now, but if we had to write the exam today, you know, you probably would fail."
Right.
And I said, "I probably do okay."
Yeah.
And he said, "I'll make you a deal.
Yeah.
You write the exam today.
Yeah.
If you pass, you don't have to come back to my class for the rest of the year, but you have to stay out of trouble."
Nice.
So I sat down. He moved my desk outside in the hallway.
Yeah.
Like, he was making an example of me. Mm-hmm. He was trying to, like, make everybody else in the room afraid to not do their homework.
Ah.
He put me out in the hallway. I wrote the test. And I whenever I write a test, I wrote a couple tests recently. For one was my DZ license because I joined the fire department. Mm-hmm. And so I write tests fast, like really fast. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the test. I put it on his desk and I sat down in the mm-hmm. classroom. And he sat and he started going through the test. And I could see the checkmark motion of his hand. And it started getting aggravated and exaggerated. And he put the test down in front of me and he said, "You got 78%. You passed."
Wow. So he came good with his work.
He came good. And I went down to shop class.
Yeah.
I hung out in the shop class.
Cool.
I used to bring my motorcycle to shop class
and
work on it.
So you had a motorcycle when you're in high school. That's pretty cool.
I didn't even have a car license.
Yeah. I guess, so you got a couple of years on me. By the time I was at that age, they made it harder to get your proper license. So you could only get your G1 when you were 16. So I couldn't get my proper license till I was probably 17 or 18,
mm-hmm.
you know, or something like that. They made it a little challenging.
I got my motorcycle
probably because
license.
Of you.
No, I was good. I even took the course at Humber College and everything. But when I moved out west, I went to get my license for, like, transferred to BC. Yeah. And they were like, "What's a Class M?" I was like, "Motorcycle?"
Yeah.
And they were like, "You can't do that. You have to have a GM license." I was So they made me do the car license. And then once I'd written the car license and done the road test, they said, "Oh, it's been too long now. You're going to have to do your road test on the motorcycle again too." So I had to redo the written and the road test for the motorcycle.
And you were only there for 11 months.
And then I left. I couldn't. The weather out there is just dreary.
I know people say that it's so beautiful, but when you're in the coastal BC and you're like 3 months of rain a year, it's a lot, you know, it's a lot. So Chris, is there anything that you could share with, I don't know, somebody that's of any age group that's looking to maybe get into blacksmithing, that wants to try it out, maybe, you know, just as a hobby? Is there kind of a starter kit? Is there a few tips you could share from your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it can be an expensive hobby to get into, especially because anvils are collectible. But you know, you just need an anvil shaped object. So any lump of steel would do. Some people use a piece of railroad track if they can get their hands on it. Find somebody who can get a short piece of railroad track and mm-hmm. mount it to a stump. And
yeah, you don't want to just go cut one out of a railway.
Probably not a good idea. Yeah. And you can't just go taking it off the side of the rail. Sometimes you see pieces there and you mm-hmm. can't even railway spikes. Mm-hmm. I always buy the railway spikes because I make tomahawks and things that are railway spikes. And people say to me, "Oh, I know where there's a big pile of those on the tracks." And I'm like, "Yeah, but they'll tend to fine you if you're trespassing on the tracks."
Yeah,
so not to mention getting hit by a train's not high on my list of things to do.
No. Yeah. Or derailing one.
Yeah. So I just buy them.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's blacksmithing courses. I know there's a place in Toronto called Axe Academy mm-hmm. and you can build an axe.
Oh, neat.
And you can go there. And I don't know if it must be more than one day. Unless they pre-do a bunch of stuff for you, I'm thinking they wouldn't. I'm thinking it's probably like a two-person team, and you have a striker, and the smith is like guiding, orchestrating. Basically, you're holding the workpiece, and then somebody else is swinging a hammer.
Okay. And that's kind of like a class, a workshop.
It's a class. You can take. I don't know how much it costs, but it you know, whatever it is, it might be $300 for the day or something. I have no mm-hmm. idea, but you know, something like that, get in there and do it. I mean, you're going to get hot scales going to land on your hands and it's noisy and, you know, you may find it's not for you. So before you go and invest thousands of dollars on an mm-hmm. anvil and hammers and a forge and a space to do it, I would say find somebody that'll give you some time in their shop,
mm-hmm.
pay them for some time in their shop. And, try it out. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where can you connect with others in the blacksmithing community?
Oh, there's Facebook groups. And, yeah. There's lots of places to connect. I would just Google blacksmith courses near me and you'd probably come up with Axe Academy and all those in the Toronto area. But wherever you're at, there's probably somebody doing it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blacksmiths, believe it or not. It's not a, people say, what is it like to do a dying trade? I said, I don't think it's really a dying trade. It's a dying, it's a dead trade. It's not a trade anymore. Like, people don't hire a blacksmith when they build a new house like they did. There's no job posting for a blacksmith for the most part. Now it's more like an artist blacksmith or a, you know, you're making, it's a niche thing. Like you're going to make certain things and then people will appreciate your work and buy it. But, you know, it's not the same as it used to be. You're not the utility guy that you used to be as a blacksmith. Now.
Yeah, no, like definitely, but there's still a space for it. Is there something that you like most about it? If you could refine that down to something that really,
I always say it's my immortality. I think because I'm making something that is like that axe head from Abitibi, you know, I'd love to know more about the blacksmith who made that.
Oh yeah.
You know, I'm too bad his name isn't stamped in it or we don't know the whole story. So I stamp my work with my name. And you know, with today you got the internet, so you could Google that and you'd probably find something about me and, you know, maybe they'll find your videos and they'll watch a video and, you know, this could be 50 years from now, I'll be dead. And they'll, somebody might pick up your axe. One of your kids might pick up your axe, you know, and say, oh yeah, there was a video about that. And then watch the video and then they would see me and you and you know, we were young. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's in a way, it's like your videos is your immortality. As long, as they, as long as they exist in some form. So as long as my videos or my work exists in some form, then people are going to have a reason to remember something about me. Probably all bad, but.
No, that's neat. Yeah. Steel lasts a long time. These things we create last a long time. Yeah. That's neat.
I have an axe that's from, Quebec, hewing axe. So like the axe that the settlers would have used to square up logs for their permanent house. And, you know, it's marked Washburn. And so I have a book on axe makers and there he is. Washburn tells you when he was born, when he died, where he worked, who he worked for. Then he opened his own shop. Then his son took over.
What like, year was it?
1860, something like that. Yeah. Cool.
Is there anywhere where people can have a look at some more of your work? You know, you have some instructional type videos on your YouTube channel.
Yeah. So the YouTube channel is just my name, C. Johnston, blacksmith. I have a website, which is cjblacksmith.ca. You can see
and you can buy stuff from there.
You can buy stuff from there. Yeah. Like I said, I don't, I generally don't take orders for axes, mostly because I haven't had my power hammer running in almost a year now. I had a problem with my eye actually last year. So I was avoiding any like heavy duty hammer work. My retina was going to detach. So anyways, I got the go on that, but then I haven't had the big hammer running. So making big axes like yours is kind of not feasible unless you want to come over and swing a sledgehammer for a couple hours. Yeah. But little things I like to make, fireplace tools and
Cool. And you sell all that through your website?
Through the website. And then I've got Instagram, which you had mentioned already, which is, what is it? Adventure_forge.
You got it.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, Chris, man, it's been a great chat. I really appreciate you taking the time. You didn't, you'll have to paddle here next time just to keep with our
It'd be easier to paddle home, wouldn't it?
Much easier.
Yeah.
Much easier.
Yeah. You could paddle to my place. I'll drive you home and then
Sounds like a plan. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Chris.
All right.
Yeah, have a good one.